My name is Todd Searle. I'm obsessed with watches. I pay attention to them everywhere I see them. I'm specifically focused on independent watchmaking, a niche world within the watchmaking sphere inhabited by some of the most talented watchmakers and most interesting people and interesting stories from around the watch world. On Forward Momentum, we'll talk about watches, cars, the luxury goods market, and of course, a little bit of Formula One. Join me as I interview the journalists, retailers, and collectors who support these independent brands, and of course, we will certainly hear from the watchmakers themselves. Welcome back to Forward Momentum. What's going on, watch fans? It's Todd Searle. Welcome back to Forward Momentum. I kind of wish we had the Alan Parsons Project music, or at least the rights to use the Alan Parsons Project for today's guest. He's a good friend and a true collector and a lover of independent watches. Possibly the meme lord of the watch community, we might say. I'm happy to welcome NYC Watch Guy to today's chat. How's it going, man?
World's falling apart, but we're still standing, so can't complain.
That's a good thing. That's very true. So I kind of want to just jump right in here. You know, I know watches are a huge passion of yours, but you said that basketball was your first love. How did you fall in love with basketball, and then where did watches enter the picture?
Yeah, I tell people this all the time, because people look at me and think that I'm super obsessed with watches, which I am. But I say, if you compare my level of obsession with basketball to watch, like, basketball's here and watches is not even on the chart. That's how low down watches are, or I could say that's how high up basketball is. And, you know, fact of the matter is, if you told me today, gun to my head, every single watch I have has to go and I can never buy another watch again, I'll be honest with you, I'm not going to lose a night of sleep over it. I'd just be like, you know, that's life. But if you came to me and said you can no longer play basketball or watch basketball, have anything to do with the game of basketball, it would in many ways feel like life was over for me. And so I think that pretty much explains to you what the game of basketball has meant to me in my life. It's pretty much been everything for the longest period of time. It's my safe space. You know, if things are not going well in life, you go over to the basketball court, and it's meditation, it's therapeutic. Everything just goes away when you're playing the game of basketball, and you can be at peace. And so I think for me, it started when I was probably 2 or 3 years old, just being placed in front of a television watching Michael Jordan play basketball. And I think those early years of not really knowing what I was looking at, but watching this game, and which to me is the most beautiful thing on earth, it sort of just captivated me. And from there, every decision that I've made in my life has pretty much been around, how do I play or watch a basketball game? And to the point, people, when I tell people I'm the biggest fan in the world, they go, no, you're not. I know this guy, or I am that guy who can give you a run for your money. And then I go, I skipped my own sister's wedding for the Final Four, and I didn't even have a team in the Final Four. I go, imagine telling Indian parents that you're not coming to your own younger sister's wedding because you got to go to a basketball game that you're not even playing in, right? So to me, that's sort of how obsessed with the game I have been. And I guess for the longest time, I've said, yeah, the game of basketball will never cheat me, and I try never to cheat the game of basketball. But, you know, you grow up and you find out maybe personal relationships are a little more important than inanimate objects. I'm still trying to get to that point, I guess, to some extent. But watches for me kind of became, it was a gradual rise to becoming an obsession, I think. I always liked physical gadgets and toys and couldn't afford any watches growing up. So I always had like bootleg G-Shocks that I would buy from the stolen goods bazaar in India. They would break every couple of months, and I'd go buy another one for, you know, a couple hundred rupees. And my first real watch that I bought was when I was probably 3 years out of school, out of college. I was running a startup. I didn't have a lot of money. I'd saved up about $3,000, and I bought a Zenith El Primero, a modern version, not the vintage. I do have the vintage now, but I bought a modern version of it, and I was happy as a clam. For a year, I wore nothing but that watch, and I said to myself, there's really no reason for anyone to ever buy a second watch. It was crazy enough to spend $3,000 on a watch. There's no way I'm ever going to buy another one. Like, I'm good. I'm done. And then I happened to find out about Lange, and I Googled the brand because I'd seen one in a window, that led me down this rabbit hole into Hodinkee and forums. And before you knew it, there was this whole world of watches that I had never known, I could have never imagined existed. I mean, I thought $3,000 was expensive for a watch. I thought Rolex was the pinnacle of watchmaking. Little did I know that I was barely even dabbling in the hobby. And then once I started reading about the independents out there and saw what guys like Max and Erwerk were doing, it just took everything to a whole new level. And once again, I think for me, being a startup guy, being a gadget guy, you kind of start to gravitate towards the independents because they're taking risks and doing things that are very different from what the mainstream brands are doing. And all of a sudden, I was hooked onto this thing. And every time I made a little bit more money, I would buy a watch and I'd buy a watch. And then, you know, you wake up 10 years later and you're like, holy shit, how much money have I just spent on watches?
That's a relatable story, man. Yeah, I feel the same way, because I feel like when I started buying watches, like Tourneau was the only thing I knew about. And I, again, like you, thought Rolex was the pinnacle of watchmaking. Didn't know that there was anything else out there. Like, and then this whole world sort of opened up over time, and the world of independent watchmaking sort of became like open to me, or like the doors open. And I was like, oh, this is what I've been looking for this whole time. It's just taken a long while to get here. I'm curious about basketball. What is it about basketball as a passion that pulls you in? Because I know for so many people, basketball is not necessarily, maybe all-encompassing is the word, but it just pulls people in. And there's such passion behind it, not only for watching and appreciating the game, but also playing the game.
I think it's a whole host of things. So one, basketball, when you watch basketball, unlike watching football or soccer, basketball is played in tight corners, right? You can see everyone's face. You can see the emotion on people's faces as they play the game. You can see the sweat literally trickling down somebody's face on television, at least these days in HD. You can see all of that. Game of football, you've got a mask on. You can't see the person. Soccer, the field is so big, you literally can't, you can't even tell who's got the ball most of the time when you're watching a soccer game. And so I think basketball, first and foremost, it's played in such tight quarters that you actually see everything that's going on, and you feel the passion and the emotion of the players. Two, it's a game that it's physical, but it's not that physical, right? And what I mean by that is, as a 5'10" Indian kid who weighed 135 pounds soaking wet coming out of India to college, I was not in a position where if I got hit on a basketball court, I'm going to die. If you put me on a football field, I would have actually died from the first hit that I took from an American football player, right? So basketball, in some ways, when you think about its global appeal, I think it's that anybody can play the game of basketball. It's also one of the only sports that you can play on your own in your driveway, in your backyard, because all you're doing is shooting a ball, and the feeling that you get every time that ball goes through the net, it's like nothing you'll ever feel anywhere else. And you can't really do that with other sports. What can you do on your own on an American football field? What can you do on your own on a soccer field? There's just not much you can do. And so I think there's aspects to basketball that lend itself towards being great if it's just one person, great if it's two people, great if you're playing 3-on-3, if you got 5-on-5. No matter how many people are out there, you can make something of the game of basketball and have a ton of fun playing it. And that's why it's sort of truly become this global game that now brings together people from around the world. You know, last year I was in Croatia, and two things happened. One, I started my trip in Zagreb, and Zagreb's the capital of Croatia. I was there. I met with a guy who was sort of the general manager of the local basketball team, like the professional top tier league in Croatia. The team out of Zagreb is called Cibona, and it's the same team where Drazen Petrovic, who died in 92 in a car crash, played. And he would have gone on to probably be one of the greatest players in NBA history had he stayed alive. And so they walked me around the stadium. He took me around the city of Zagreb. We're sitting in a cafe just talking hoops. And this 70-year-old guy who's sitting next to us in this cafe hears us talking, and he turns to us and he goes, "Are you guys talking about Cibona?" And we say, "Yeah, why?" And he goes, "I played for Cibona 50 years ago. And we go, "What?" And he goes, yeah, like I've lived here my whole life. I played for the pro team. And he said, you know, back in the 1950s, the NBA sent 5 all-stars, Jerry West, Bill Russell, Oscar Roberts. He starts rattling off the 5 of the greatest players of all. He says, they came here and they played a pickup game against us. And I played in that game. And I'm sitting here going, I am on the other side of the world having a conversation in a cafe. And there is a guy who played against Bill Russell sitting here. This is fucking insane to me. And so I immediately bought a stake in that team in Croatia because I don't think I'm ever going to be able to afford an NBA team. So for me to say that I have ownership in a team across the world, regardless, it's a pro basketball team. It was amazing to do that. And from there, we went to Dubrovnik. And in Dubrovnik, you have on the top of the castle, one of the greatest basketball courts anywhere in the world. It's a rooftop basketball court overlooking the Adriatic Sea. And so if you're shooting the ball and you look behind the backboard, you have all the orange rooftops of the city of Dubrovnik and then the Adriatic Sea. It's the most picturesque thing
That's awesome.
You'll ever see in your life. So I go there the first night. We hike up. We get to this court. It's probably 11 p.m. And I'm like, man, there's got to be a basketball there that I can shoot with. Get there. It's empty and there's no basketball. So the very next day, I go to a local sporting goods store. I buy a basketball. And we make the hike back up to the court around 4 p.m. in the evening. It's boiling hot. And I get up there and I start shooting the basketball. And within probably 10 minutes, tourists start to come up to see the basketball court from all over the world. And I'm the only guy who has a basketball. And so people start coming up to me and going, hey, can I shoot the ball? Can I shoot the ball with you? And so this group of tourists from Argentina show up. We don't speak the same language. But we all understand this. We understand what basketball is, and we understand what a 3-point shooting contest is. And so I, along with 3 tourists from Argentina, spent the next 20 minutes having a 3-point shootout on the most beautiful court in the world. And we all understood each other. And so to me, it's a brotherhood at the end of the day.
Dude, that's amazing. That's awesome. That's such a cool story and such a cool experience. And like having something like that that links you to other people around the world, regardless of culture, regardless of language, just like is the coolest thing. And it's the coolest feeling when you get into those moments because it feels like those absolute moments of flow. And for me, like watches have done that thing for me. And there's lots of other like connections that you could have, but that's such a cool connection to people, especially to be the only guy with the basketball on the court. That's pretty cool, man.
Yeah. And I was going to say the parallels to watch collecting to me, I mean, it's nothing in the world is apples to apples, but I always say to people, once you get out of college and you have a real job, it's hard to make friends. Like, where do you make friends? Unless you're one of these super social people that's out drinking and clubbing every night, which I am not. I don't drink. I haven't been to a club in 15 years. It is really hard to make friends. And so if I look at my entire friend circle today as a 37-year-old, outside of my core friends that I grew up with and went to high school, middle school, college with, every single person that I am friends with today, I've either met on a basketball court or I've met at a watch meetup. That's the only way I meet people anymore. And so both of these hobbies have actually become really important for me from a social perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's crazy how I feel like both of them can kind of take over your life in some ways. You know, like you could go to every watch meetup, you could play in every pickup game, you could go do every last thing. But sometimes you like, I think it's good to have like for you to have basketball and watches to have that just balance between those two things and to be able to like choose one or the other and kind of not spend all your time doing one of them. Because I think you need that balance, especially in the watch industry.
Well, I definitely can't afford any more watches. So if I was doing that full time, I'd be in real trouble. Basketball's a little cheaper. It's $300 a month for my Equinox membership, which at the time sounded crazy to me when I first moved to New York, going, I'm sorry, how much for a gym membership? But now I'm like, wait, $300 is the cheapest form of entertainment that there is in the world.
That reminds me of a friend of ours who recently moved to Dubai. And maybe the potential pitfalls that he could get himself into with watch collecting. Speaking of, we'll come back to topic here. I'm curious about your like entrepreneurial journey. What got you interested in entrepreneurship? And then how has that kind of translated to life and what you're doing now?
I'm pretty sure from the time I was 5 years old, I knew that I cannot hold a job. There's no way I'm employable. 9 to 5 is out of the question. I would not survive in a corporate environment or frankly working for anyone else for more than a week. Definitely going to get fired. And to me, self-awareness in this life is half the battle. And I think that is the one thing that I knew about myself right from that age was I got to do something on my own because it's not going to work for me otherwise. And So, you know, all through middle school, I was the guy who was selling candy to kids in school and selling toys and whatever. Wherever there was an arbitrage opportunity to buy low and sell high, I would do it. I get to high school, I was the only guy with a CD writer. And so I would burn, you know, mixtape CDs and then start pirating movies and whatnot. In India, you know, pirating is, sure, it was fine here too, but in India, it was really the Wild West. No one's coming after you for that stuff, right? So I was out there selling all that stuff in school. I get to college at Penn. I ran an eBay store out of my dorm room. I would buy laptops, concert tickets, whatever was possible to buy at a discount and then wait and resell for a higher price. I was on it. I was making a ton of money as a college kid just doing that. And so it's sort of, I feel like, ingrained in me from the youngest of age, this very simple concept that if you can buy something at a lower price and arbitrage it at a higher price, there is always a business to be had doing that. And so that's what I did for probably the first 20 years of my life. And then I get towards graduation. All my classmates have been doing internships for 4 years. They've got the JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs jobs lined up in New York. Meanwhile, I've been doing all for 4 years other than playing basketball and selling to people, right? And I go, goddamn, I got to find something to do that's worthwhile of my time. I can't move to New York without a job. And so luckily, I had been a walk-on basketball player my senior year at Penn, spent a ton of time in the locker room, got to see what coaching staff was doing for game day preparation and realized that there was a massive opportunity to build software that could help automate a lot of the stuff that they were doing and make better sense of the data. And obviously I'm Indian. I was born able to code. And so I went back to my dorm room and I started building software for the Penn basketball team. And then I realized, well, if Penn needs this, then there's probably thousands of other teams around the country that would use this as well. Set up a company called Crossover. And for the next 8 years, I lived the dream in New York City. I got to do the next best thing to being a pro basketball player, which is I got to sell my product to the best teams in the world. And I met with every college coach, every NBA guy. It was a ton of fun. I had about 120 people on my team here in New York. We ended up with about 10,000 sports teams around the world as clients. Ended up selling that business in 2017. And basically from there, I said, well, I got two things I can do now. I can go start another company, or I still want to stay somehow connected to the world of entrepreneurship, but without necessarily having the weight of the world on your shoulders. And that became venture capital as the next best thing to actually running your own business. And so I launched a fund in 2016 that was the very first institutional fund that was focused on the worlds of sports, gaming, and collectibles. Sports and collectibles, the two things that I love most. And gaming just sort of being an offshoot of both of those things that we felt there was a ton of opportunity to invest in. And it's been a hell of a ride. Over the last 7 years, my team and I have now invested in about 120 companies in these spaces. We're lucky enough to be the first money in StockX, turned into a monster. On the sneaker side, we were the first money in The Athletic, which the New York Times bought last year. And so we've gotten to continue to do everything that we love to do, just from slightly, you know, a step away from being operationally involved in the businesses, which I think I've sort of found my sweet spot with companies now, where I don't necessarily want to be the CEO of them, but if I can be on the board, I can give them capital, and I can give them the playbook, or at least help them avoid a ton of the mistakes that I made while being an entrepreneur, I think I'm doing my job. So it's been a lot of fun now, especially given our collectibles focus that I lead. We've been able to start to play in the watch world from an investment perspective. And so now I'm once again like getting to bring my passions together. And that's the one thing I always said. It's been 15 years since I graduated college, and I do not feel like I have worked a single day in my life. And if I can go another 20 years and I can retire and say I didn't work a single day in my life, that'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's super cool, man. I don't think many people get to live that at all. And it's amazing that you get the opportunity to do that, or that you've built the opportunity for yourself to do that. How does tech change the watch industry, right? Like, you know, 3D printing, additive manufacturing isn't really a thing in the watch industry because the tolerances are so tight. But, you know, you can use it to prototype and to learn. But how does technology change the, like, other parts of the watch industry, like secondary watch markets, retail? Like, what changes in those spaces with technology? Or what are you thinking about?
Yeah, so one of the theses that we've had for a while has been around the idea of what we call the unbundling of eBay. You know, eBay was sort of the catch-all place on the internet starting in 1995. To this day, still a monster business. But back then, trading cards, sneakers, watches, handbags, all of these things were nothing more than a hobby. Most of these items, I actually say, start off having some utility. So watches, when they were invented over 100 years ago, watches were invented for a reason. They had a utility, which was, it was the only way to tell time.
Yeah.
And then we got to the point where we all now have an iPhone in our pocket that keeps better time than the best tourbillon that Mr. Jorn can invent. And yet, watches have now gone from having no utility into an asset class and a store of wealth, and they're worth way more as a quote-unquote useless object on our wrist than they were ever worth when they actually had utility. And as this has happened, I think that eBay is no longer the best place to buy and sell things, because when you're starting to buy things that are more and more valuable, you need a specialized marketplace for all of these asset classes. And so, you know, we invested in StockX because we felt that the sneaker market needed to come off of eBay and it needed better authentication and a better buying and seller experience. And now there's five companies in the sneaker world that are worth over a couple billion dollars on the secondary market. The same thing is true now for watches. You know, Chrono 24 is 15 years old, monster business, but that site hasn't changed in literally 10 or 15 years. It's still a terrible experience. They don't give you any value other than it's just a place to list watches. And so I went and invested in this company called Bezel that is just doing a significantly better job of authenticating every watch, better user experience. You go on the Bezel app, you feel like staying there every day. It's just beautiful UI, UX. And sometimes that's all it needs. You just want people to feel happier with where they spend their money, as opposed to a shitty old website that hasn't changed in forever. And so, you know, those are the sorts of places where I see a change in with technology in the world. It's just more making things more fun to use, making things faster, making transactions safer, a better experience for everyone. That's all it takes sometimes. And then I think as these objects have become a true asset class, there's so many other things you have to worry about. So insurance, the value of these items has gone up so much. I invest in a company called Wax that is now sort of the leader in the insurance space in the US, and they actually just launched in the UAE a week ago, and our mutual friend who you mentioned is now working with Wax as the representative in Dubai. So that's going to be a fun one for us. I also look at things like liquidity. If you're a super high net worth individual and you bank with Goldman Sachs, if you had $1 billion in art and you went to Goldman, to your banker, and said, hey, listen, I need $200 million as a line of credit against my artwork, they'd say, sure, Todd, here's $200 million at 5% interest because we know exactly who you are and we know what artwork you have. But if Vasu, who's got a pretty nice watch collection that's worth a decent chunk of change, if I go to Citibank where I bank and I said, hey guys, I'd like to take out $500,000 against my watches, even though it is the safest loan in the world for them to give out, there's no world in which I would not get laughed out of that bank. Where is the solution for people like us to be able to get liquidity against our collectibles without having to sell them? Those are the types of products that I see over the next 5 to 10 years. Technology is going to allow us to make those transactions happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a lot of sort of downstream effect that people don't think about in the watch market. It's just sort of like, oh, okay, like I want this watch. I either go to that boutique or I go to this retailer. I get the watch and then like I now own this thing. But you don't think about the things that you need to do with that watch, like insure it, make sure that it's kept safely, make sure that, like, again, like, if you want to borrow against your collection, you're able to actually do that. Or if you want to, you know, be able to have a like real-time value of your collection and understand sort of where that stands and what that stands as a part of your net worth, you know, those are kind of like downstream tech or downstream effects that I think technology could have a huge impact on. That's fascinating, man. That's really cool how you're looking at the market too, and kind of how you're looking at watches, not just as a collectible, not just as an asset class, but as, you know, sort of in comparison to like trading cards or sneakers or something else, like including them in that same like bucket of collectibles. Because I see the art comparison a lot, but getting compared to other stores of value, I don't see as frequently.
Yeah, to me, watches probably, I mean, I personally think of watches as wearable art, but in many ways, I think they are closer to some of these other asset classes, because with art, the difference is everything's a piece unique, right? Everything's a one of one. There is no skew. Whereas with watches, that's not true. Yes, there are some one of ones, but the bulk of the market is still items that exist, and there are many of them in the market. And so there's a lot more comparisons there, I think, to be made. And ultimately, to me, watches fall somewhere between all of those things, but they're here to stay. They've withstood the test of time. I even compare them in some ways to alternative asset investing in the form of stocks and bonds. Like people say, well, you know, how much of your money do you put into watches versus stocks? And I go, listen, every time I've bought a stock, it goes down instantly. Like instant. You want to short a stock, ask Vasu what he just bought, and then go short that thing, because you will be guaranteed to make money. So there's no point in me picking stocks. I don't have more information than the hedge funds and the Wall Street guys who are doing this for a living. I invest my money into ETFs and I let them ride. I will never pick another stock again because I'm terrible at it. There is no information asymmetry that I have. But guess what? I spend so much time on watches. I know way more than 99.9% of the world when it comes to watches. And I don't buy them as an investment. But in terms of putting my money somewhere that I feel safe, there's no place other than watches that I would do that, because I believe that I know more than the average Joe.
Yeah. And you're a high conviction operator in that space. And that's kind of become a driving principle for me too, is like not putting anything out there that I don't have high conviction in and that I believe in myself.
Yep.
And I think that's a huge difference maker. And I see the approach that you're taking too with your investments in the watch space, and think that that's really cool, man. I'm happy you're doing that, because someone needed to come in and shake up the collecting space.
This is true. You know, there is no venture fund in the universe that has a focus on collectibles. We were the first ones to do it with sports 7 years ago, and over the last 4 years, collectibles has become an actual vertical on our website that we say, you know, we are focused on, and it's because it's white space. We literally were the first ones to say that we're going to become collectibles experts, and we've now replicated what we did with StockX in the world of art, in the world of Pokemon cards, sports memorabilia, watches, and we're going to keep doing this. There's all these opportunities to build the next version of what forums and other online communities should look like. And literally every week I hear 10 to 15 new pitches on things in the collectibles world that, you know, look, all of them are not going to return the type of money that we need. And so I can't back every one of them, but there are so many entrepreneurs now that have started to realize that this is a $600 billion market in the world of collectibles that for the most part has been transacted offline or on eBay. And as this becomes a $1 trillion industry over the next 10 years, almost all of it is going to happen online, which means there's going to be so many opportunities for tech businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's crazy to think that, you know, it's a $600 billion sort of market, and to think of what watches like makes, comprises of that market, it's nothing in comparison to what else is out there and what opportunities exist. That's crazy cool, man. I want to come back for a second just to watches and talking about, you know, we were talking about forums and information before this, and like how much information about watches and the watch market is just locked up in forums from like the early 2000s. And you and I have spent a lot of time digging in forums to learn, to get information, to find out about references. And I'm curious, when did the sort of doors to the world of independent watchmaking open to you?
It was almost instant. So I tell you, my first watch was a Zenith El Primero. My second watch was a Frederic Constant, because I happened to be in Istanbul when I started, when I really got the watch bug. And I just went to the local store and I was like, what can I afford right now? And I had $2,000. So I bought a Frederic Constant world timer. But from there, it escalated quickly to a JLC Master Geographic, because I just love world timers. I bought a Glashütte Original Panamatic Lunar. So like, those were my first four watches. And then I immediately jumped into Arnold and Son, of all things. Like, I was like, the HM big moon that they had, I was like, this is crazy. Like, look at this moon phase on this thing. Granted, you know, it was an all rose gold watch, which I probably wore six times before I sold it, because when the f*** am I going to wear this thing? But I went right down that rabbit hole, then found Jorn, then found, what was the next one? I bought an MB&F LM101. Like, to me, once I had sort of dipped my toe into the world of watches with a few affordable pieces, I immediately went right into independence, because to me, like back then, when this was 10 years ago, there was no burgeoning secondary market. Nothing was trading over retail. To be honest with you, I tell people all the time, I think half the reason I went to independence was, on the one hand, they were cool and they spoke to me. But on the other hand, they were trading for 60% off retail. It was the only thing I could afford. I couldn't afford to buy something I wanted from Patek, but I could buy an MB&F for 60% off retail. And I looked at the value that I was getting based on retail price to where they were trading. I go, I'm buying this all day long. I remember a Jorn CB for 17 grand on a forum, which that was the biggest purchase I'd ever made in my life. And I'm sitting here shitting my pants going, I can't believe I'm wiring somebody $17,000 on the internet and praying to God that this watch is actually going to arrive. And so, I mean, it was just so much fun back then. You know, it was finding these deals. It was scouring the internet looking for stuff. To me, there's no fun in walking into a boutique and making a purchase. That's not what collecting is about. That's just consumerism. Like, that's having money to go drop a credit card. The most fun that I've had is searching the internet for a great condition Universal Geneve Nina, and then an evil Nina, and then a big eye, and then an evil big eye. And like, going down that path of years and years of finding vintage watches in great condition, that's when I was having the most fun, when I think back to it. Now I've got some money, and now you're playing this game of trying to appease your sales rep and make him think that you're better than the other 50 guys on his list to give you the allocation. It's not fun, man.
Yeah. I'm with you, man. I think about this all the time. I miss the days of like Panerai, when, like, you know, your average Panerai is, you know, back in the day was trading somewhere between like $4,000 and $7,000. And that was really fun to hunt for different Panerais, try them. And then I went through a big phase of vintage Hoyers and finding vintage Hoyers. And then, I mean, like, you ever bought anything in truly crap condition? Because I've done it. And so, like, you know, you buy watches in completely crap condition and you try and find better versions, or you buy it, you try it, and you're like, eh, okay, this wasn't for me. And you flip it on a forum and you don't really lose anything in it, but you get to try and experience it. And I think you're right. I think collecting has changed so significantly in the last decade, at least for watches, that it kind of becomes an unfun game at a certain point. And so I'm always trying to figure out, where is the fun in this game? And like, what's the fun to be had? And so I'm rehashing this in a series right now, thinking about like what I learned in collecting. And, you know, I think everybody looks at, you know, collecting as sort of an end game, where I think the journey is really fun. And if you reach the end game, you got to find a way to make it fun again. And you got to go back and like visit your archives or things you liked. And like, man, do I like want to add a Universal Geneve to this, you know? Or, you know, like, do I want to go look for a great example of a, like, German military Hoyer, or a great example of Rolex sub, like, whatever that thing is? I think there's always ways to add fun back into it. But yeah, I think it's worth acknowledging that collecting can be a really unfun space at times.
You know, well, not to get philosophical, but when you think about sort of the primal or innate need that I believe almost every human has for collecting. I read this stat the other day, almost 50% of the world collects something. And that could be fingernail clippings for all I care. But like people collect, everybody tries to collect something. And when you think back, like humans are hunters and gatherers, right? That's where we came from. I feel like when you start to get too deep into this hobby, or at least where we are now, the hunting part is gone and we've just become gatherers. And therein is where the fun has been lost, because the hunting part is the journey. The gathering part is the end. And we have gotten to the point where if all you're doing is walking into a boutique or waiting for a phone call to come from your sales rep saying, hey, your watch is here, you're just a gatherer now. Where is the hunt? Where is the joy? And for me at this stage, I think honestly, the joy is only coming from the community aspect of it and the friends that I've made and the chat groups that I'm in. That's really the only true benefit to all of this. There isn't that much joy, to be honest with you, when a watch comes in. Like, how many can you have?
Yeah. And then you get it and you're like, okay, on to the next thing on my list. I've been thinking a lot about this lately. And actually, this was a book I wanted to write on why we collect. And I think there's a lot of interesting research out there. I think there's a lot of psychology tied into this. And speaking of, you know, not getting too philosophical, but I was talking to Martin Free yesterday from Urwerk, and Martin was like, oh, that's an interesting concept. You know, in the Bronze Age, when you had like, when you were a baller
That's because like, Martin actually lived in the Bronze Age.
he's amazing. But he's like, you know, you would go drop like bronze in the, like you would have excess. So you'd go drop it in the rivers as like a sacrifice to the gods. And you're like, oh my God, like, you know, like it's insane how innate this is as part of our DNA. And it's a little disturbing. Yep. And it's not just watches. Like you said, it could be fingernail clippings. It could be sneakers. It could be hats. You know, like I cull my hat collection like every quarter. And I'm like, why do I have this many hats? Like I don't wear these. Like, why do I have these here?
At least I wear my hats every day. So, you know, there's a reason I've got a hat collection. I don't know about you.
I wear like, I like wear like four or five at a time. I have them like on the hook by our back door and I'll rotate through those five. And then I'll go into my like bin of hats and I'm like, why do I have all these? I've just been wearing these five. And then I like trade those fives out for another five. And then inevitably in that group, like there's one or two that I'm not wearing. So they don't make the cut and they get kicked out of the house. So it's I don't know, man. I think just collecting is like innate in our DNA can be kind of a scary thing.
Yeah, I'll tell you one of the things that I had the most fun with towards the middle or end of the pandemic was, you know, if you remember, everything went batshit in the pandemic because everyone was at home and there was nothing to do with your money. You couldn't travel anywhere, so people started to buy shit. And trading cards went through the roof right off the bat. Like a Jordan rookie that was sitting on eBay for 10 grand reached $750,000 at its peak, right? In the middle of the pandemic. So I'm sitting there looking at this and I went, there's no way I'm buying cardboard for that price. Like this is nuts.
Yeah.
I have no interest in it. But I said, what else is there that looks like cards, but is rarer and people haven't thought about it yet as a collectible? And I went ham on the ticket stub market. So I started to research the greatest moments in sports history that I thought would be culturally relevant even 50 to 100 years from now. And I started to look for ticket stubs from those events. And over the course of about 2 months, I amassed a collection of about 300 ticket stubs from all the greatest moments in sports. So I have Michael Jordan's debut for the Bulls in 1984. There are not a lot of those ticket stubs left. I managed to find one for 13 grand, which at the time was insane to pay $13,000 for a torn piece of paper. Late last year, one sold at auction for $450,000. So I bought up some amazing ticket stubs, but more than anything, it brought the joy of collecting back because there was no secondary market of playing. Like this was me hunting. Like it was pure hunting for 2 months on forums, on Facebook pages. That like I started to move the market so much that people started to reach out to me from like this very niche group of ticket stub collectors going, hey man, we've heard you're buying a lot and markets are moving on eBay. Like, what the fuck's going on? Is there something we don't know? And I was like, no, I just like ticket stubs and I'm buying cool stuff. And so then I start to think of like, beyond just the obvious things like Jordan's debut and Jackie Robinson's first home run and all of this stuff, what else is fun out there? And so I'm sure you've watched Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Are you kidding? That's one of my favorite movies.
Well, you know, he goes to a Cubs game, right? That's an actual Cubs game. I have a ticket stub from the Cubs game that Ferris goes to during the shooting of that movie.
That's amazing. We got to get Broderick on the show and get him to sign that, or get him to sign something along with that. So Matthew Broderick, if you're listening, or Broderick's agent, or anybody who knows Broderick, hit us up here at Forward Momentum, because we'd love to get him on the show and talk about Ferris Bueller's Day Off too. Well, I'll work on that, man. I'll see what I can do.
Sounds good.
How about Cubs World Series?
Wait, speaking of the Cubs and the Cubs World Series, I'm pretty sure I also got a ticket stub from the Steve Bartman game.
Okay, perfect. There you go. There you go. I would be upset with you if you didn't have something from the Cubs World Series. It's as a Chicagoan, it's near and dear to my heart. It's important to me. And the fact that they'll probably never do it again while I'm living is, also important.
Yep.
Amazing, man. Well, hey, I want to respect your time. This has been awesome. I've loved hearing about what you're up to, what you're looking at, and what you're thinking about with the markets. And like this last, little bit of conversation has really been relevant for me, because I've been spending a lot of time thinking about what's missing from collecting. And I think it is the hunt. And that hunting part is what made this fun in the first place, and the learning and looking for information. I'm always learning. I'm always looking for information. I'm always meeting with watchmakers and learning more about them, and learning more about the process of building watches. But I don't think I have the time or patience to go sit in watchmaking school and learn how to physically make these things. And I've been told by one watchmaker in particular, like, no, absolutely not. Like, even if you went to watchmaking school, I wouldn't hire you in my studio. Like, you're too ADHD for me. Like, I was like, cool. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. But I've got a couple more questions for you. I'm curious, do you feel a need to protect watchmaking?
I don't know if protect is the right word, but I feel like with the audience that I have unwittingly amassed on Instagram, that I do feel a personal desire, at least, and to some extent a responsibility, maybe, to expose the world to more than just Rolex and Patek and AP and RM. And I can't tell you how many messages I get on a weekly basis from people that I will never meet in my life who DM me and say, hey man, I just bought this MB&F or this Moser or some independent. They go, it's because I saw this watch on your page and you opened me up to this world that exists outside of what I'd always known. And so I don't consider myself a protector of the industry in any way. I far be it for me to say I have that power, but I do think the responsibility that I have, given how many people now follow me and take what I say, perhaps with a grain of salt, but take it to mean something, that I should be telling people about the good stuff that's out there and get more people exposed to the fun that there is in this hobby outside of the boutiques on Madison Avenue here in New York.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And I appreciate that. And one thing that I am like totally remiss from not asking you about is your Instagram account and becoming like the meme lord of an entire generation of watch collectors. How did that come about?
I can't remember why I started making memes, to be honest with you. Like, I'm the class clown. I can't have a conversation with anyone, no matter how important the meeting is, without starting the meeting off with a joke. That's just the way I do things. And I found it to be disarming. I find it to be endearing. I'm a bit of an introvert. I certainly, like, if you put me in a room with 100 people, I'm the guy who's in the corner watching basketball on my screen and not talking to anyone. I do okay if you put me in like a group of two people, but like once it's bigger than two people, I'm out, guys. And so in many ways, it was strange to me to have 40,000 people all of a sudden that are, interested in what I have to say. And it's easy to be a keyboard warrior and do this from behind a screen. But on the other hand, I think it's just in my nature to try and make people laugh, because I feel like as an introvert, it's the easiest way I have to break the ice with someone is be funny.
Yeah.
And so I think I simply extended what I do in real life, which is always start off with some sort of self-deprecating joke. I try to do that on the internet, and I guess memes were the only way to do that on Instagram. And it kind of just took off and people started to vibe with them. But I also think the main, I mean, there's probably 10 guys that do this on the internet for watches, right? But the difference, I think, is 9 out of those 10 people have never shown their face. You don't know who they are. They are not spending an inordinate amount of money on watches. They're not deep in the industry like I am. They're not investing in the industry like I am. I think the difference between everyone else, and I love all of those guys and their memes, and I laugh at all of them and I reshare them. Nothing against any of those guys for what they do, because I think they're all great at it. I think the reason my stuff resonated so much was because people see me still buying watches on a regular basis from the same brands that I'm talking about in my memes. And they go, hey, like, this guy's a customer, but he's still willing to point out the shit they're doing wrong. And ultimately, I just say, listen, man, if you can't be lighthearted and have fun with this stuff, then what's the point? Like, if we're going to take a hobby so seriously that we can't poke fun at ourselves and the insane amount of money and the stupid things that we do for allocations, then what was the point of any of this anyway? And I think that that's sort of why the account grew like it did. It was purely because people said, hey, this guy's keeping it real.
Yeah. Yeah. I would 100% agree with that. And I love that you are willing to make fun of stuff that you yourself have put your money behind as well. I'm curious, outside of your account, what would be your favorite Instagram meme account or Instagram watch account? Either one. And you don't have to say mine because you're here. It's okay. I'll accept other answers.
You know, from a pure photography standpoint, obviously, Waitlisted does some awesome stuff. A Collected Man and Esper Lux both do really good shots of the watches they're selling. I feel like the photography's off the charts. From the meme side, you know, Brodinky does good stuff. Who else is out there? Watch Taster, I think, is the other guy. There's Shame on Wrist.
Shame on Wrist. Yeah.
That guy posts very, very infrequently, but when he does, holy shit, he comes with a right punch, a left punch, and a knockout on whoever he's going to slander that day. So yeah, I feel like if I wake up in the morning and I open Instagram and a Shame on Wrist post there, I'm like, oh shit, something went down in the watch industry last night, and I've got to catch up on the news
on what's going on. Yeah, absolutely, man. I appreciate that. What's currently getting the most wrist time for you?
To some extent, it's always like whatever came in last just by default gets,
yeah,
you know, the first couple of weeks of wrist time. Nothing's come in the last couple of weeks. So I'd say, you know, this is probably my favorite watch ever, even though it's on a Ming bracelet and not on the $60,000 Jordan bracelet.
You didn't have to say it. You didn't have to say it, man. We can edit that out.
I keep it real. I keep it real at all times. And so the Acrivia AK06 are both getting a ton of time. They're just the best watches that I own. But this is a big year. Like, I've got a Resonance coming in a matter of a week or two from Jorn. That's a watch that, I'll be honest, the first four versions of that watch just didn't speak to me. Like, I know it's blasphemous to say that in the world of Jorn, but like, I didn't care. Like, I get it. It's cool. Like, yes, it's cool. But like, I didn't care. And then the RQ, the latest version, came out, and there was just something about the way he had modernized the aesthetics of that watch that really spoke to me. And so I asked for one 4 years ago when it was 110 grand, and now it's 160. So, but I guess better late than never.
Never.
I've got that. I've got a Simon Brett coming later this year. We did nice. Something with Sylvain Pinot that's coming this year. This is going to be a big year, and the year hasn't even goddamn started, and I'm already like, fuck, I'm broke.
Which explains why you're back in the office. Got it.
Exactly.
That's awesome, man. Good for you. Congratulations in advance. I'm sure we'll talk about those more later.
No doubt.
In one sense, what's one thing that you wish people knew about watches or the watch industry?
That it's not nearly as stuck up and you may think from the outside. I've met very few absolute they do exist. They do exist in this hobby, but they are far fewer than I ever anticipated. And the bulk of people that I've met over the course of the last 10 years have been nothing short of spectacular, passionate people who truly have a soft spot in their heart for watches and watchmaking and the industry. And like, we're not all a bunch of rich like, there's people in this hobby that are truly doing this for the passion of it. And it's been fun to meet those people and continue to meet those people and to be friends with them. It's been great for me professionally. It has been great for me personally. I've learned a ton from people. And it's like, I tell people all the time, my Instagram has gotten to the point where I can go to any city in the world and I post one story saying I'm here. And within 2 hours, I will have 10 guys who will come to my hotel and they'll say, we will take you around. We'll take you to the best restaurants. Let's have a watch meetup. I go, I basically have a personal tour guide in every city in the world now. And all it takes is one message on Instagram. That's pretty special.
That's awesome, man. That's very cool. Yeah, that's just awesome. Where can people find you? Where can people get their daily meme dose?
Obviously, at NYC Watch Guy on Instagram, best place. And I try to respond to everyone who's ever DM'd me. I think everyone will agree. If they've DM'd me and it hasn't been spam or someone trying to sell me something, even if it's a one-sentence reply, I do my best to respond to everyone. And I've ended up meeting so many people just because a random person DMs me and says, hey, I'm going to be in New York next week. And I have no idea who this person is or whether he's a serial killer, but I'm still here. So it hasn't been Ted Bundy on the other side of any of these. And, you know, hopefully we can keep that going.
Absolutely, dude. Well, thank you for the time. This has been awesome. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate the sort of like honesty and just the forthrightness on everything, collecting and where you see markets going. It's been awesome, man. Thank you for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We'll do it again.